I'm Alex Breitenbach.
I'm Sean Cabrera.
And thank you for tuning in to this special episode of the Big Red Hockeycast, brought to you by the Big Red Sports Network. This week, we are truly honored to be joined by the authors of Forever Faithful, Celebrating the Greatest Moments of Cornell Hockey, Arthur Mintz, Class of 71, and Jim Roberts, Class of 71. Be sure to use our promo code on the Cornell University Press website, which can be reached at cornellpress.cornell.edu. When purchasing, use promo code 09SAVE, all caps, for 33% off the Forever Faithful book. And with that, let's jump right into the sin bin. Welcome back to another edition of the Sin Bin on the Big Red Hockeycast. And this week, we have two very, very special guests. Thank you both for joining us. And how are you guys doing?
Just fine.
I'm doing good, except I'm in the middle of this huge gap between the first part of the hockey season and the second part of the hockey season. And I'm hoping we're going to be able to pick things up when January rolls around.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Hopefully. So with that, let's start at the beginning. So I just want to ask, what inspired you both to write Forever Faithful, a book about, of all things, Cornell hockey? What inspired you?
Well, I can give you the backstory of the origin story of this. I was the editor and publisher of Cornell Alumni Magazine, which doesn't exist anymore. That's another story. But I was in that position for 14 years, from 2000 to 2014. And while I was there, I worked with the Cornell University Press occasionally. We would publish excerpts from upcoming books sometimes. And I got to know Jonathan Hall, who was one of their marketing guys at the time. And one day we were talking about an excerpt we were publishing, had some sports information, including some stuff about the hockey team. And I started talking about the hockey team. Jonathan mentioned he had read some of the things in the magazine that I had written about the team. I'd done some game accounts. I'd interviewed Ken Dryden when the new version of his book, The Game, came out. And I'd been very involved with covering the team over the years. And Jonathan said, "Well, you're really interested in the hockey program, aren't you?" And I said, "Oh yeah." I said, "You know, I had the good fortune to come to Cornell in 1967, right after they had won their first national championship. The first college hockey game I ever saw was at Lionel Rink with Ken Dryden in goal, which was a pretty good place to start." And Jonathan said, "Well, you know, we've been having some discussions here at the press about doing a new series of books, some of which would involve sports. Would you be interested in working with us and in writing a book about the hockey team?" And it took me about, 10 seconds to go, "Oh yeah, let's continue this discussion. Let's keep going." And actually, after I retired from the magazine, which was in September of 2014, I came back to Ithaca and had a meeting at the press with Jonathan and several of the other people there, including one of the editors named Michael McGandy, who ended up being the editor that I worked with on the book. And we just kind of brainstormed, talked about how this book might come about, how they wanted to do it, what they would like me to do. I don't remember exactly, and Arthur might, whether Arthur's name came up in that meeting. It may have, but I said, "I'm going to need somebody who really knows the program inside and out to work with as a research partner on this." And Arthur was the obvious candidate for that. And we started working together fairly early on. And the interesting thing on my part is I had already left Ithaca. I had moved out of town. I live in New Hampshire now. I had moved to New Hampshire right after I left the job. So I wasn't there, but Arthur is. And so I had these great partners in Ithaca to collaborate with on putting the book together. And we spent quite a bit of time talking about how they wanted to do it and at the press on what it might look like. And the original idea was to do a little background history on the program and to cover 12 important games that had been played over the years, both for the men's and the women's team. It was very important to involve both programs. And 12 became 24. By the time we got the book done, because so many games came up. I had some ones that I knew about that I wanted to cover. There were other ones that Arthur suggested when I started talking to people in the program, and especially talking to the current coaches, to Mike Schaefer, Doug Dara. They had ideas very definitely about games where they had either played or coached that they thought should be in the book. So this list grew and developed from there. And you know, shortly after I had that meeting at the press, I got a contract signed on, said, okay, let's go. And we started to write the book. I mean, Arthur, I'm going to ask you, exactly when did they contact you and bring you in? I don't remember the details of that.
I first heard from Michael McGandy, I think it was April of 2014. I got an email from him that they were talking about doing this project. Would I be interested? So Michael and I got together and we talked about what the thing was going to be. And then I didn't hear a whole lot for a while. And the project really started taking off in the fall of 2014.
Now, Jim and Arthur, did you guys know each other when you first went to Cornell, or did you meet each other through the book? I'm just curious.
We didn't know each other when we were at Cornell, even though we're both in the class of 1971. We had never met, but then again, you know, huge Cornell classes. But we had met over the years during my time at the magazine. And Arthur and I had had a number of discussions at, class meetings and like maybe Keiko's midwinter meeting and stuff like that. We'd had some discussions. We got to know each other a little bit. And I was really pleased with the idea of being able to work with him because I'd sat in line rink and listened to him so many times. I knew what he knew, that, you know, that he would be the perfect partner. And the great thing for me was I was out of town. He was in town. And the way we began to work together was once we had decided on some of these games, Arthur did the legwork in Ithaca. He pulled up game accounts in both the Ithaca Journal and the Daily Sun, which he scanned and put into a Dropbox. It gave me access to, which was fantastic. And later on, that's how we did the photo research too. Both Michael and Arthur would find things that they would put in the Dropbox for me to look at. And we were able to collaborate that way. The other big part for me was, in addition to trying to assemble some of this background stuff, which we can get into, like the front part of the book, where there's chapters about the rink, the fans, all the Cornell traditions, all the things that go on at Lionel Rink, and some of the great rivalries. That was the background, and I consulted a lot with Michael McGandy about how we were going to put that together. I would draft things, send it to Michael. He'd say, I like this, I don't like that. Arthur would weigh in on what he thought should be in or what should be left out. And in the process of doing that, we started to focus on this list of games, pick the first one. And I said, okay, well, we're going to go all the way back to, you know, early, very early in the program. I wonder if I can find anybody who played in that game who remembers it. And my initial concern was, I'm going to have to go to the players to talk to them about what happened in these games. Are these guys going to remember what happened in the 60s and 70s and 80s? Not only did they remember, it was like, for most of them, it was like yesterday. I got them started and they just, you know, you see, if you look in the back of the book, the list of, I talked to almost 60 players and coaches. All of them were great. All of them loved talking about it. Some of them had to be kind of nudged a little to get them in, you know, to get a contact, but all of them were just tremendous in giving me their memories of the games and how the big plays came about and what was going on in the program. That was really gratifying. It was incredible. There are a lot of stories there, including some that didn't go in the book.
Some of the things that happen with teams, they're better off, they just stay with the team. But it's always interesting hearing old players talk about their experiences with their teammates within the team.
Yeah, not to tell any tales out of school, but here's just one that was great. One of the guys I wanted to talk to about the 1970 team, the undefeated team, was Brian Cropper, who was the goalie. And Brian was hard to reach. It was like the program didn't have an email for him. And I was told, well, Brian's gotten tired of talking about it. He doesn't really want to talk to folks. But fortunately, one of the people I did talk to from that team was Garth Ryan, who was just a tremendously helpful guy and just wonderful to deal with. And he said, let me call Brian. Let me call Brian. So we called him up. And next thing you know, Ryan's back to me and he says, yeah, here's his number, call him. And I called up Cropper. Once I got him on the phone, I couldn't get him to stop. He was great. And I kept trying to get him to go back to talk about the big games. And all he wanted to talk about was the stuff the team was doing around the program. And one great story he told was, on the night before home games, Ned Harkness would take the team and make them all go down to the boathouse and stay there together. He didn't want them out roaming around Ithaca doing whatever they might be up to. He said, no, you guys, he put us all in a boathouse and he you know, like lock the door, and we had to stay in there overnight. And he said, okay, one night, like somebody's standing up on a chair looking out and says, Harkness gone? Yeah, he's gone. His car's gone. He says, okay, well, look. And somebody, they had arranged with somebody to sneak down the driveway to the boathouse to pick up some of them to go out to the wherever they were going, whichever Ithaca establishment they had in mind. So they go out and they get in this car and they're driving up the driveway with the headlights off. And they got about halfway up the driveway. All of a sudden, lights come on and Harkness is sitting up across the road in his car. Turn around and go back. Says, yeah, we never tried that one again. There was no way to beat Ned on it. And there were, you know, a bunch of stories like that, stuff where Ned would have to kind of rein these guys in, because as great a hockey team as they were a bunch of characters too. And it was just some fun stuff. And Brian, he just got into those stories and off he went.
That's a golden story, let me tell you that.
Yeah.
That's golden.
Yeah.
I want to bring back to the fact that you mentioned the process of getting the photos. And obviously what really stood out to me was really the amazing photos in the book. So, you know, whether it be Ken Dryden in his famous stand-up position leaning on his stick, or, you know, just the general old pictures of Lina. So can you speak more to the process of finding and collecting all those amazing photos?
It's your department, Arthur.
Yeah, researching the photos was my job. Jim had done all the interviews and he had put together an outline of what the text was going to be. And he put together a schedule of the kinds of pictures that he thought would illustrate the story best. My job was to go to various sources, look through whatever source material was available, and try to find pictures that fit. I went into it with a mindset that I didn't want to just have a book that was team photos and headshots and pictures that had appeared in Cornell publications dozens and dozens of times. I wanted to dig a little deeper and see what I could find. The first place that I looked for photographs was in the university archives. One of the collections they have there is the papers and photographs of Saul Goldberg, who was a photographer for the Ithaca Journal for many, many years. And one of the things buried in this box of stuff that Saul Goldberg had donated to Cornell was a bunch of negatives taken from the very first game played in Liner Rink, which I believe was the New York Rangers against the Rochester Americans. Now, these are negatives, you know, little tiny things. You have to try to figure out what the image is. But once I saw these things and I was able to see what the images were, I said, this is the kind of stuff I'm looking for. You know, this is stuff that hasn't been published a whole lot, but it really illustrates the history. So we got a lot of stuff from the university archives. From Cornell Athletic Communications, they have extensive files there, a lot of photographs that have been published, but they also had books and books of 35 millimeter film strips that had been taken at the various games. And again, trying to figure out what the images were and how they would fit was a lot of the job. I would go there, spend several hours looking through these books, picking out things that I thought would be candidates that would look good in the book, and then figure out how to get an image from 35 millimeter negative to something that Jim and Michael could look at to evaluate whether it was appropriate or not to put in the book. And a third place that we got a lot of photographs from was the Cornell Daily Sun. They also had extensive photo archives going back to the mid-1960s. We got that image you were talking about of Ken Dryden leaning on his stick. There's one image that has been published about a million times. I was able to find one from an NCAA semifinal game back in 1967 that I had never seen published before. That's the one that's in the book.
And that one was particularly tricky. I remember I said, oh, we got to have Ken leaning on his stick, and there should be lots of those. Ha! Turned out to be pretty tricky. one of the things I was worried about, particularly the early games from the 60s, was whether there was going to be good photos of the players. And one of the first images that turned up, I'm going to, you guys have seen this, but this picture of Lang Kennedy, the goalie in 1962, I saw that and I just flipped. I said, oh man, if they're all that good, we're in great shape. I mean, there's a lot of them guys just standing around holding sticks, but that was such a great photo of him. And he turned out to be such an amazing story. He was like the first person, the first player that I called. And he had a long history. He'd been the athletic director at Cornell later on. And I was worried, you know, is he going to want to talk to me? Again, as soon as I got him on the phone, off he went talking about that great game against Harvard in 1962, which was kind of the first game where Lina went crazy, because Harvard had been a dominant Eastern program for quite a few years. They'd been beaten on Cornell badly for years. And then all of a sudden, they pulled off this tremendous upset, won the game 2-1. Fans went crazy, and that was it. That, you know, Lang said that's when Lina Rink became Lina Rink. And off we went, you know.
Yeah, I had known Lang Kennedy for many, many years, going back to the 1970s. Lang used to coach at Ithaca High School. Then he became the athletic director at Cornell. He had worked for Alumni Affairs for many years. I met him with the Ithaca Stars. The Ithaca Stars were an outgrowth of essentially the local Ithaca Beer League. A lot of players were playing in that league. They had former Cornell players. They wanted a better caliber of competition than they were getting in this recreational league. So they formed this team that barnstormed around the state for a number of years, and Lang was the coach for many years. So I had heard a lot of stories from Lang over the course of that. I knew Lang would be a great source for you, Jim.
No, I was reassured by the fact that you knew him, but I was still worried. Okay, is he going to remember anything about this game? Boy, did he. And the other guys from that game too, the other players, went all the way back to 1962. And, you know, do you remember these particular plays? Do you remember how the goals were scored? They sure did. And, you know, all of those guys that I talked to, Jerry Kostendorf, you know, I don't know, just three or four of the guys from that team. And they had just wonderful memories of the experience and just what it had meant to them at the time.
I guess he's somewhat touched upon this, by the way. I was wondering, like, if there's a director's cut to this book, because, you know, obviously, just out of curiosity, were there many photos you had to leave out due to lack of space?
Yes, that's the short answer. I literally looked through more than 10,000 images.
Oh, my word.
I selected probably, what, Jim, about 500 or 600 that you and Michael looked at?
Yeah, and we looked at easily 500 or 600, maybe more. I mean, there were a lot of times it was like, there were a lot of photos. The funny thing was, the early games, it was hard to find anything other than the kind of standard publicity photos.
Yes.
Once you moved up to the digital photo era in the 90s, the problem was exactly the opposite. There were hundreds of photos for some of these games, and it was just exhausting trying to go through and find the ones that really fit with what was in the narrative, so that we could see the right players and the right moments in the game. Yeah, poor Arthur did just an amazing job digging these out and giving Michael and I something to work with. And Michael is certainly the third person who put a tremendous amount of time and effort into doing this book, working with me on how to develop the text, and then working with both of us in selecting these photos. And he did a lot of digging himself, going through photo files. So
wow, that's unbelievable.
One of the interesting things about looking at all these photographs, it's not like these things are all laid out and nicely arranged and they have paragraphs and paragraphs of descriptions about them.
Yeah.
They're basically in a folder or in a binder with the date of the game. And it was up to essentially me to figure out, what are we looking at here? Who are these people? Where in the game is it? Is this actually one of the interesting moments that we're looking at? So what do you do there? You find old rosters so you can match the numbers up so you know who the players are. I had an extensive collection of score sheets that I had assembled over the years, largely because of my my work at the games, first as official scorer and then as public address announcer for many years. So you use those stuff as clues to try to match up what you're seeing in the images with what the reports of the game say.
Yeah, I would get these Dropbox downloads where there'd be a number of numbered photos to look at, and Arthur would have a tag with each one of those photos, a little description that told me as much as he knew about it. And frankly, a lot of the captions in the book are my adaptations, my plagiarism of Arthur's descriptions. Just, you know, I would use his wording pretty exactly, add some things to tie it to the text, but very, very collaborative in terms of how all those captions were developed to make sure that they were accurate, for one thing, and that they really worked with what was in the text. And I didn't want them to just repeat things that had already been stated in the text. I wanted the captions as much as possible to be able to add additional information and to really enhance the experience. So if you were just kind of flipping through the book, as I knew a lot of people would do, they'd stop and read captions about a particular game they'd been to or one that they remembered, and use those captions to kind of trigger their memory of the images. So yeah, the photo research was an incredible piece of work. Basically, it took me one year to write the complete draft of the book, the pretty complete manuscript of the book, and a second year to do all the photo research and to write all the captions and then work with the people at the press to lay it out. So it was 2 full years of work and then some, right, Arthur? Yeah,
it was 2.5 years from when I first heard from Michael McGandy to when the book was published.
Well, I mean, I think it worked out perfectly. I mean, you could tell that it's a project of love, you know, for Cornell and just for the hockey program in general. So, I mean, you know, needless to say, but kudos to that. Now, earlier we did mention, you know, Ken Dryden and his famous stand-up position, you know, leaning on the stick. So, Jim, you know, you were the one who worked with Ken Dryden on the foreword of the book, you know, and Dryden is obviously a living legend, both for Cornell hockey and just, you know, the hockey world in general. So what was it like to get to know him and, you know, to work with him in a professional atmosphere, especially after he was someone you looked up to, you know, you looked up to him really all the way back since your freshman year?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In fact, I'll tell you my freshman year Ken Dryden story. I mean, after going to see him play a bunch of times, and, you know, he was a big man on campus and I was just a Cornell freshman, you know. Yeah. One day I'm coming back down the hill to go to I lived in the university halls, the godforsaken dorms, which they have since replaced with something that someone might want to live in. And I'm coming down the hill, and just as I'm crossing the road there on the path going towards the U-Hauls, I see this guy walking along in front of me, kind of a big, tall guy, loping along, and he turns off to go to one of the fraternity houses down there, and I went, oh, my God, it's Ken Dryden. I didn't have the nerve to go up to talk to him at the time, but it was just like, just seeing him on campus, it's like, wow, he's just a student like me, you know? And then later on, you know, got to follow his career when he was with the Canadians, always admired him, read his book, The Game. And that's kind of how I reconnected with him when I was back at the Alumni Magazine. A new edition of The Game came out, and I got a phone number for Ken from the Athletic Tour. I called him up, said, you know, do you have time to talk about the book? He said, sure. And we had just a tremendous, tremendous interview with Ken, talked about the book and a lot more. And a couple of other times I was able to just have brief contact with him. I don't think I've ever actually been in the same room with him, except line and rink. But when the idea for the book came up, I immediately said, oh, Dryden's got to write the foreword. You know, this is the only thing that's going to work. So I reached out to him by email. I said, you know, you got time to talk to me about this. Gave him a call. And he said, of course, absolutely. Within 2 weeks, I think, he had sent me what he wrote that's there in the book. And I didn't change more than 5 or 6 words in it, I don't think. You know, it was just a beautiful piece of writing from Ken, who's a very scholarly guy as well as a brilliant, you know, athlete and commentator. And not only did he do that, but he was a great source in talking about the 1967 championship, putting me in touch with some of the other guys that I interviewed from that team. And just, he was like, anything I can do to help, you know? And just, I'm still in awe that I can just call up Ken Dryden on the phone, you know, and get a conversation. And since then, over the years, he has sent me stuff. When his latest book came out, the one he wrote about head injuries in hockey and the measures he's recommended to improve that. I did a story for the Alumni Magazine about that too. And we had another long conversation. He's been sending me links to newspaper stories on that subject, you know, cause he's, as you probably know, he's been very outspoken on things that should be done, rules changes that should be made to protect the players, particularly from head injury, from all kinds of injuries, but particularly from head injuries and from the danger of traumatic injuries. So Ken, just when he jumped in and said, I'll do it, I said, then this is going to happen. This is going to happen. You know,
let me tell you, I envy you, especially for being able to work with him. I envy you.
Yeah. It's been great. It's been a thrill, you know.
One Ken Dryden story. We were racking our brains. Where are we going to find an image of Ken Dryden leaning on his stick that is not the image that has always been out there? And Jim, I never told you this. We overlooked probably the most obvious place in liner rink.
Hanging on the wall.
Outside the dressing room, hanging on the wall. They have photographs of all of the Cornell alumni who have played in the National Hockey League. And the picture of Ken Dryden is Dryden in his Montreal Canadiens uniform, leaning on his
stick. That's the one they made. There's a statue of that out in front of the forum, right? In Montreal. I've never seen it, but I've seen pictures of it. But I didn't want him in his Montreal uniform. I wanted him in his Cornell gear, because that was my memory of going to see him play. I says, this team is tremendous. And look at the goalie just kind of standing there leaning on his stick, watching the guys at the other end beat the crap out of the other team, which is pretty much what they did every night. But it was great.
That is truly remarkable. A future six-time Stanley Cup champion, albeit, and a living legend for the Cornell Big Red. Now, I just wanted to ask you both, in the 2.5 years roughly that you spent writing this book, were there any moments during the writing process where you faced any writer's block, or like, you know, you just didn't know what came next?
Writer's block was a luxury I couldn't afford. You know, it's like I knew I had to get to as many of these guys as I could. And especially with the older games from the 60s and 70s, these guys are getting older, you know, and some of them, unfortunately, since the book was written, some of the guys I talked to are no longer with us. Really, particularly the 70 team, Dan Lodbo died not long after I finished the book. And then, unfortunately, John Hughes, who I got to know quite well over the years at alumni events and working on the book, John died last year. And that was a real heartbreaker. But I felt like I had to just stay on the case. If there was any block, it was maybe a little bit early on, not being quite sure how to do some of those background chapters. One of my original ideas was for the tradition to pull a lot of stuff that had already been written about it and just to sort of do a compilation, you know, of different things that had been written about the Cornell traditions. And I tried to put something like that together, and it just wasn't working. And Michael finally came to me and said, nah, that's not working. You need to take all this stuff and write it, you know, in a consistent way to talk about what these traditions, where they came from and how they've come together, whether it's the cowbell or, you know, all of the various insulting chants. And it's there. So that part, sometimes I hit some walls trying to piece that together, but it all worked. And I really just felt energized a lot talking to the players. And if I felt like I was bogging down and going, oh my God, I've got 20 games to go. Nah, just keep going. Finish a game. On to the next one.
Yeah, I didn't have to worry about writer's block because I wasn't doing any of the writing. But I did have to worry about several of the games we found millions of images for. Several of the games, it was very scarce what was available. And Michael and Jim and I spent a lot of time talking around, what are we going to do for this game? Because all we've got is, you know, these two headshots and this team photo. What else can we do? And fortunately, everything seemed to come together in the end. I think the finished product is excellent. But it was a bit of work to scrape together some of the material for some of the games.
Oh, absolutely. And I appreciate all the work you guys were putting in. I kept going, can we get a picture of this guy? He scored the big goal. Well, we can't find anything. Well, go here, go there. You know, and a lot of people, you know, at Cornell jumped in at the archive, at the at athletics. People really, once they got used to hearing from you in particular, Arthur, they were, I think the degree of cooperation we got was outstanding. And stuff popped up, like, you know, Corey Earle coming to me at one point with something that he had found in the sun while working on one of his Corneliana lectures that he does that I never would have seen, you know. And he came to me and said, here, can you use this? It was like, oh, man, that's perfect, you know. So it was a real collaborative effort from the Cornell hockey community.
So the both of you graduated in 1971. Now tell me what it was like on campus when the 1970 team, the 69-70 team, went undefeated. What was the feeling like on campus? Because I'm sure that's something that we probably will never, ever experience again. And for two living legends that were actually there themselves, it is, I definitely want to hear about that.
What do you remember, Arthur?
Mostly what I remember is my trip to Lake Placid to go to the national championship tournament, where our car broke down on the thruway and we ended up hitchhiking and spending a night in Scroon Lake, New York, missing the first semifinal game, eventually getting to Lake Placid. And then dancing with the players on the ice after the game, after they had beaten Clarkson 6-4 and Dan Laudbo had his hat trick. Players passing around bottles of champagne, smoking cigars. That's what I remember. I can't tell you about the atmosphere on campus. I don't know how to convey to Sean and Alex what those times were like. The Vietnam War, the Strait takeover, Nixon invading Cambodia.
It was a complicated time.
You can read about that stuff in historic newspapers. Jim and I lived through it.
Yeah,
it's hard to explain what things were like then.
Yeah, it was a very difficult time because of all that. Although I got to say, you guys are living through another very, very difficult time to be a college student. We didn't have to worry about, you know, getting a disease from somebody, but we did. We were constantly, our time on campus was constantly being disrupted by demonstrations and events like the Strait takeover and what happened after that. The one thing I do remember about it is I don't think the hockey team was as big a deal in undergraduate life then as it became later, when people would camp out for days to get tickets. I mean, when I remember when I first got tickets, we had these little books of coupons that let you get tickets to athletic events. And you just showed up in line and gave one of these coupons and went in. And
really? Wow. Yeah, that's
when I was a freshman, that's my memory of it. Later on, I'm not sure by the time we were seniors, whether you had to stand in line or not, but that came about more later. Because of all this other stuff was going on and there were so many other distractions, you know, people weren't as focused on some of the athletic events, but I do remember that the hockey team was a tremendous unifier. No matter who you were and what you felt like or what you were worried about, you were glad to see what was going on with the hockey team. It was really a thrill, you know. I envy you, Arthur, for having gotten to Lake Placid. I didn't get there. I remember listening to that game on the radio in the place where I was living and following it all the way through and having a big celebration with my roommates when I said, hey, they won it. Damn. And I don't think at the time we had any idea how significant it was that they were undefeated. It didn't, you know,
like it didn't click almost.
Yeah. It didn't click that this is never going to happen again. And it's not going to happen now just because they play too many games and there are too many strong programs. It's happened in women's hockey. Was it Wisconsin, Arthur? I think we had an undefeated women's team, I think, a couple of years back.
Can't help you there.
Anyway, but yeah. it was a big deal on campus, and there certainly were celebrations after the team came back. But, you know, I think years later, I realized how big it was.
Certainly. Oh.
I was going to say, throughout the book, you know, there are obviously so many games that encapsulate the Big Red hockey program. It's, you know, incredibly rich history. Uh-huh. But one in particular that really stood out to me was the 1979 6-5 overtime win against Providence. Now, you know, whether it was the fact that we beat Coach Lou Lamoriello, who was GM and coach of my favorite NHL team, the New Jersey Devils, or, you know, it was a surreal comeback from being down 5-1 to win in overtime. You know, the question that I want to ask you guys is, do you have a favorite game throughout the years or a memory that stands out as your favorite?
I can jump in because, I mean, I wasn't there in 1979. I wish I had been. Because the guys that talked about that game were still excited about it. and the funny story is that I there's a quote there. I talked to Roy Ives, who was the radio announcer. And in the book, what it says is Roy was overcome by emotion and unable to speak. What Roy told me, which I left out of the book out of courtesy, was, I wasn't just overcome, man. I was under the table throwing up. Since I couldn't get back on the radio until I stopped throwing up. He was just, you know, it was that kind of event for the guys there. My particular favorite is the 2003 ECAC championship game against Harvard, where they were down with less than a minute to go and scored an unbelievable goal to tie the game. And then Sam Paolini just nailed one in a minute and a half into overtime to win the game. I watched that game on television. I wasn't there. I watched the whole game on television. They had a rebroadcast the next day. I watched the whole game again the next day. Because wow. And then, you know, a year later, I watched the highlight reel of it. To me, that was such an exciting, because I loved that team. That was such a powerful team. That team went to the Frozen Four and came this close to winning the national championship. And that was just such a great team to watch. That actually, I wrote an account of that game that went into the Alumni magazine, and the chapter in the book about that game is almost directly the story that I wrote in the Alumni game. I added a few things to it, but it's pretty much the same.
I have been to so many Cornell games, and I've been directly involved with so many games, both as public address announcer in the years that I traveled with the team, writing for the Ithaca Times and working for sports information, that they all run together at this point. It would be hard for me to pick out two favorite games, but let me talk about the two games we've just spoken about. First, the Providence game, and that's all you mention to anybody of that era, and they know exactly what you're talking about. I was in Liner Rink for that game, and the atmosphere at the end of the second period was total despair. We were down, I believe it was 5-1. We were getting totally outplayed. And then we just started chipping away at them. When Randy Wilson got the puck on the breakaway against the empty net, we figured the season was over. And to this day, I don't think he or anybody else can tell you how we managed to miss that shot. And if that wasn't enough to make the game totally bizarre, what followed was... Steve Hennessy picking up the puck, just firing it down the ice in desperation. Lance Nethery gathering the puck in, stepping over the blue line and firing a 60-foot slap shot to tie the game. And then Robbie Gemmel winning it in overtime. I've never seen anything like it, and I don't think I will ever see anything like it again. The 2003 championship game, Mark McRae was the player who scored the tying goal with seconds to go in regulation. I was sitting in the stands behind Mark McRae's father, and I will never forget his reaction when the puck.
Oh my goodness.
I'm not going to try to describe it, but I will never forget his reaction. I don't think I have ever seen anybody so grateful for something that happened during an athletic event.
Yeah, that must have been something to have in there. Yeah, to go back to the Providence game just for a second, obviously talking to Lance Nethery was key for me in being able to have an account of that game. And he's in Germany. He was at the time he was in Germany. It was very difficult trying to get any kind of telephone connection. So yeah, I think that was one of the only player interviews that I did by email, but he was just fantastic. And what's in the book is just what he sent me word for word was his memory of taking that shot. And he said, I didn't know how much time was left. Once I got that far, I just let it go. He said, you know, and the ice was all chopped up and the puck spun and the goalie missed it and went right through his legs, you know? And what he said after that was, I love this. At the end, he said, due to the unlikely circumstances that surrounded that goal, the game will be etched very clearly forever in my memory, you know? And it's like asking him to talk about it. And it's like, all he has to do is throw the switch and he can see himself on the ice, looking up at the goalie going, got to shoot it now. Amazing, yeah. Amazing. And that's the game that's frequently mentioned as the greatest game ever in liner rink. And I saw a lot of good ones there, but that one would be hard to top.
Yeah. I would believe that. I can't even imagine what it would be like to be in liner rink and to witness an event like that. I mean, well, that experience for me was definitely the 11-3 victory over RPI this season, but I mean, that's just one that I don't even think that compares to this. Now, I just wanted to get to ask this question. Now, one of the things that you mentioned in the book as being so unique about the Big Red Hockey atmosphere is the rink itself. And when compared to other notable Ivy League opponent rinks, you look at Breitlandry Hockey Center with Harvard, Thompson Arena with Dartmouth, or Hobby Baker Arena in Princeton. And what stands out about Lina is the remaining rustic and primitive feeling about the rink as a barn sort of place. Now, and comparable to these other really, really upscale hockey arenas, the question I have is, some may feel that the rink is due for an upgrade. I, in my personal opinion, I disagree, but what is one thing that you would never change about Lina?
Good question. The seats. It's supposed to be uncomfortable. It's supposed to be cold. It's supposed to be uncomfortable for the opponent, and you want them to be just ill at ease the whole time they're in that building. And if you made it into one of these wonderful, beautiful, modern rinks. I've been to Gannis Arena at Boston University, which is like a professional rink. It's gorgeous. The seats are comfortable. They've got nice amenities. You can go back. You can even go back and buy a beer during the game. God help it. Lina rink should never be like that. I mean, someday it's going to be too old. Someday it's literally going to be falling down and they're going to have to do something. And I rue the day when they have to, you know, tear it down and make it into something nice and new, because it's supposed to suck. That's the whole thing about it. It should be like that. And Arthur, I'm sure you could enjoy more comfort in there where you're positioned, but
I have possibly the worst seat in the building for actually watching the game. I'm sitting right next to the visitor's bench. So anything that happens off to my right, I have to look through the entire visiting team to try to see. I can't see anything. But Jim, you mentioned the seats in Lina. That is what makes Lina rink, that seating arrangement. You could not today build a rink where the seats are, well, first of all bench seating.
Right.
Everybody's crammed tightly together. It's a very steep pitch, so everybody's very close to the action. That fishbowl effect doesn't exist anywhere else. Lina itself is kind of obsolescent. It was nice that they were able to build that addition during the renovation about 10 or 15 years ago. So at least we have a relatively modern locker room facility for both the men's and the women's teams. But you go to some of the more modern rinks and you compare the facilities they have there with Lina, it's a bit of a disadvantage what we have to work with. The game time atmosphere is fantastic. The sound system, I'm not even going to talk about because I have no idea how good the sound system is. I can't hear it.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
I was impressed last time I was there that they finally put a video board up at the end. It's like, wow, we're moving into the 20th century here anyway, you know. But yes. You know, you go to other rinks I've been to, again, a Serena and BU a bunch of times because my son, despite my advice, went to Boston University instead of Cornell, which makes red hot hockey games a lot of fun for us.
Wow.
But it's all right. We've evened the record up now. It's much better. Mm. But no, I've been after he went to college, he came back when we were still living in Ithaca and we would go to games at Lydon. And he says, you know, every time a goal gets scored, he said, I look up and I go, oh, yeah. Not here. Because lots of times you watch the action and the goal goes in and you go, what just happened? You know, and without the video, at least there's some video now. But for years, it was like, you didn't know. You rely on Arthur to tell you what happened. And then you're on to the next play, you know. And wow. That's what it makes it special. And it makes it a unique place to see hockey. And I know from talking to some of the more recent players, how surprised but impressed they were when they went there as recruits. They said, I've never seen anything, I've never heard anything like this, you know, in any place that they had played before then. And a lot of them, I mean, Topher Scott, among many others, just said, as soon as I came in here, I said, oh yeah, I gotta play here.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Out of all the players that we've interviewed, they've all said that the atmosphere has been the biggest contributing factor to them deciding to come to Cornell. They said, oh yeah, this is going to be home. Like, just like you said. Now, Arthur, now for those of you who don't know, Arthur Mintz is the PA announcer at Lina and has been for the past few decades. So, and it is your booming voice that all the Lina faithful hear every game. And it's like, good evening, hockey fans. You even mentioned that in your book, those words, hallowed words, as being such a part of the experience at Lina. And now, so what is, I'll ask you this question. What is your favorite part about being the PA announcer at Lina and being part of that atmosphere?
I like watching hockey games. I mentioned the Ithaca Stars earlier in this interview. It was through the Ithaca Stars that I got to know people involved with Cornell hockey. I got to know people in what was then the Sports Information Office, now the Athletic Communications Office. And I let them know, how can I get involved somehow in this thing, this Cornell hockey thing? So back in 1983, Dave Wolheder asked me, would you like to be the official scorer for the hockey games? Because I had learned to do things like that with the Ithaca Stars. I had started working with, back then Cornell had a junior varsity program and I was doing a little work with them. So I started as the official scorer in 1983. And then a few years later, Barlow Ware, who had been the public address announcer at Lina pretty much since its inception, and who is the man who initiated Good Evening Hockey Fans. I am simply carrying on a tradition Barlow started. I didn't start it myself. Barlow, unfortunately, had an automobile accident. He broke his leg. He couldn't get around in Lina. They needed somebody to take over as the PA announcer. So Dave Wolheder, who was the sports information director at the time, asked me if I would do it. So it was my way of getting involved and giving what little bit I can back to the program.
No, that's absolutely wonderful to hear that. And also I wanted to just, can you give us here for the podcast listeners a quick 1 minute remaining in the third period? You always do that. So, hey, Mr. Timekeeper, how much time is left?
1 minute remaining in the interview. 1 minute.
I love that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Oh, my goodness.
Whenever I'm at a hockey game somewhere else and they announce there's a minute left, it's all I can do to not go, thank you. And people are sitting around me and go, what's wrong with him? You know?
No, absolutely wonderful. And now That's all the official questions we have now. I wanted to ask the both of you, do you have any other comments or memories you'd like to share with us about either writing this amazing book or your experiences with Cornell hockey in general?
Well, for me, it's funny, it came up in another interview I did about the book where somebody said, well, did you play hockey? And I said, well, not that you would notice. When I was a kid, I might've played a little pond hockey with some friends, but I mostly found the stick was a really good thing to keep me from falling down. And that was my experience playing hockey. And it was strictly as a fan. And I went to high school in Buffalo. So I'd seen hockey games on television. I'd followed a bunch of pro games on television, but I wasn't really a particularly big fan. But as soon as I came to Cornell, went to that first game at Lina, saw the team, saw Dryden, I was hooked. You know, and I've been a big fan of the game, and particularly of the college game. And I'm more of a fan of the college game and like the game, the way it's played, like in the World Juniors, than I am of the pro game, because there's too much pointless violence in the pro game, although you got to admire the skill level of the players. But for me, Cornell is what cemented my interest in hockey. And as soon as as Jonathan Hall said, would you be interested in writing about the Cornell hockey program, there was no question. It was like, this meant so much to me, and it meant so much to so many other people who went to Cornell. I'm still amazed when I meet somebody who graduated from Cornell and said, oh, I never got to a game. And I'm like, what happened? What's wrong with you? Back to Ithaca now.
That's a sin.
You know? It's a big part for a lot of people, and I'm glad it is.
Yeah.
A couple of bits and pieces for me. First of all, I am no athlete. I do not play hockey at all. I have been on skates. You wouldn't want to see it. The only sport I have ever played at any kind of competitive level was slow pitch softball, something very few people know. I was for several summers Mike Schaefer's softball coach.
Oh my goodness.
We had a team in the Ithaca City League. It was not pretty to watch either, and the less said about that, the better. Second point, the first Cornell hockey game I ever saw was my senior year in high school. Now, I went to high school in Brooklyn, New York.
Hey, sorry, I'm from Brooklyn, sorry.
All right, another Brooklyn guy. And I had applied to Cornell. I believe by this time I had been accepted. And I saw a notice in the newspaper that at 11:30 at night on the educational channel in New York City, they were going to show the NCAA tournament games. I think what it was the official NCAA tournament film. So I basically told my parents, yeah, it's a Sunday night, before school the next day, but I am staying up till whenever this is over to watch this, because I'm going to be going to Cornell, in the fall. So I had heard all the names of the people at Cornell, you know, Ken Dryden, Harry Orr, Bruce Patterson, the sophomore line with Bob McGuinn and Ted Coviello and Brian Cornell. I knew all that stuff when I got to Cornell. And that leads to the third piece. One of my favorite pieces in Forever Faithful is something that most people wouldn't even think about. It's the sidebar with Ken Gilstein.
Yeah, that's so great.
Who was the manager of the 1970 undefeated team. I had forgotten that Ken Gilstein was the hockey manager. I knew Ken Gilstein in high school. He and I went to the same high school.
Wow.
As we were preparing the book, my high school class was planning a 50th reunion, because I graduated in 1967 from high school, and they were planning it in conjunction with the previous class, the class of 66, which was Ken's class. And I saw Ken posted something in the message board we were using to talk about this reunion. And so I said, okay, I remember you went to Cornell, and we messaged back and forth, and they reminded me that he had been the manager of the team. So the light immediately went on, and I said, I'm going to connect you with Jim Roberts, with whom I'm working on this book. Let's see what comes out of it.
Yeah, that was fabulous talking to Ken, and I greatly appreciate it. And the story he told about carrying all the sticks across the ice, and the players just kind of putting him through the ritual. But he was, he was greatly appreciative. He said, you know, the players kind of put him through the ringer, but they treated him as an equal. You know, it was not like, oh, you're the manager, you know, bug off, buddy, we're the players. He said it was all one big family, and that was his experience of being part of Cornell hockey. Yeah, it was great talking to Ken. He was wonderful. And there is another great one, just one quick thing. When I was talking about the women's program, and I was able to connect with one of the top players from one of the early women's teams, Sunshine Lorenz, who sent me a little memoir piece that's a sidebar in the book that was just fabulous about her experience playing on one of the early women's teams. And it was those kind of connections that we were able to make that just enhanced the book so much. And later on, I met her at a reunion. She walked up to me, and we were at a table signing books. She walked up and said, yeah, we talked. And I said, I looked at her. I didn't recognize her. She says, I'm Sunshine. I'm like, oh, my God. Great stuff. Great stories. A lot of great stories.
Truly amazing. Truly amazing. Yeah.
One more thing I'd like to point out. We didn't talk a lot during this interview about the women's program. Mm. But one of the things Jim and I decided very early on in working on this book is we wanted to present the development of the women's program in essentially the same light as the development of the men's program, because the women's program started from less than nothing. When we were students, there was no women's team. And when the initial group of women decided they wanted to put together some kind of hockey program, they were looked down on. They were scorned. They got virtually no cooperation from anybody associated with the university administration.
They had to pay for their ice time.
Mm-hmm.
When they started practicing, they had to pay for their ice time.
Right.
They were told to go away.
Yeah, and he wanted to show the story of how this group of pioneers started this thing that has mushroomed into what has produced Laurianne Rougeau, Rebecca Johnston, Kristen O'Neill, made it all the way to triple overtime in the national championship game. We wanted to make sure that was a part of the book.
Yep. Yeah. And it was gratifying talking. Same thing as with the men players. The women players that I talked to, all of them were just phenomenal to talk to and had great memories of games that they had played in, and were so happy that they were going to be included in this book. And it's a great tribute to the women's program that they came from a meeting with John Hughes and Bill Duthie that said, hey, we'd like to have a hockey program, to this tremendous program that they have now, particularly all the years with Doug Dara and how successful they've been. Just great story. Glad we could tell it.
And I guess just to make a final addition point to that, the book does do, you know, a tremendous job. Of course, when you're talking about Cornell's rich hockey program history, it is important, like you said, to address the two teams that we have. And so, you know, it just goes to show how, like you said, Cornell women's ice hockey program itself developed so tremendously, really. And again, the book does a great job at doing such, you know, just now we're one of the top programs in the country. It's almost humbling to see our own origins to some degree. But, you know, with that being said, you know, thank you so much to Jim and Arthur for joining us. You know, the Forever Faithful book is an amazing work made with attention to detail and clear love, and is a must read. It is Bible for all Cornellians and Line of Faithful members. So you can get the book online on Amazon or in the Cornell store if you are in Ithaca. And, you know, it's a great gift for any Cornell hockey fan. And again, it's a definite must read. If you you cannot call yourself a true line of faithful till you get this book. But you know, in all seriousness, you know, thank you so much again for joining us, and thank you for listening to the Big Red Hockey Cast.
Thank you.
Before we go, don't forget to use promo code 09SAVE. That's 09SAVE in all caps at the Cornell University Press website. That's cornellpress.cornell.edu to get the Forever Faithful Celebrating the Greatest Moments of Cornell Hockey book at a special 33% off discount.